So yeah, it's probably a good idea to touch base beforehand just to double check. But
yeah,
But yeah, it's all good. It's all good. Anyway, how you doing? You been all right?
Yeah, all good. Thank you. Very busy.
Busy in a good way, I hope, mate.
Yeah, absolutely. Busy in a good way. Lots going on. Lots of new customers and challenges to solve and fun stuff.
That's good to hear, mate. That's very good to hear. And we'll dig into that hopefully at some other point because we're already live, Adam. So we better get on with the show. So welcome, everybody, to Brain Food Live on Air. It is episode 140. We're bringing it to you every Friday. So thank you so much for tuning in here again. For the folks who are listening last week on LinkedIn, Facebook, and other places, or trying to, this is the reason why I always do a sound check, because we actually failed to broadcast into those places last week. And I apologize if you were expecting the show and you didn't see it. It's part of the reason why I kind of encourage people to actually watch it on Crowdcast, because that's basically where the cool kids hang out anyway. But also, it's the place where, for sure, if we're going to do something, it's essentially the spot where it's going to be most disaster proof, I guess. Anyway, let's just do a quick sound check. So people on Crowdcast, if you can hear me okay, please let me know whether you can hear me fine on the chat stream there. Just test the audio, make sure there's no echoes, anything like that. I should be on LinkedIn, fingers crossed I'm out there. If you can hear or see me on LinkedIn, please let me know. Give me a thumbs up or something, or comment to say, yes, I can hear you, Hung. And we should be blasting this out on Facebook and on Twitter as well. In which case, if you can see me in those places and you can hear this okay, just indicate and let me know. Okay, at least the Crowdcast is okay, so we can crack on with this. All right, so a quick word to our sponsors today. We have a new sponsor for Brain Food Live today announcing themselves. They are actually one of the most exciting products in our space. They're one of the few companies, I think, that have a chance to really own a big chunk of the HR back office globally. This is a business called Oyster HR. They have raised an absolute massive amount of cash, and they're building out essentially a back office payrolling solution for companies to hire talent from anywhere in the world. One of the biggest problems you have when you hire somebody in a territory you haven't been working with before is, how do you pay that person? How do you stay tax compliant? How do you make sure this person is legally an employee of yours without having that individual set up their own company, for instance, or whatever it is? Oyster, one of those companies that basically provides that turnkey solution. So if you're not working with them or one of the two other businesses that are potentially in this space, you're making a big error. Check them out at the link I've shared in the chat screen there. It's oysterhr.com. Good to see Adam as usual. Adam always asks the question, did you read the newsletter from last week? And if so, what was interesting about it, man?
I did. And the answer is lots of things were interesting. Really great newsletter. so let's start with Madeline Lorano's TA Tech and the Modern Recruiter kind of report.
Yes.
Some things I found very exciting is the cognizance that recruiters haven't got what they need. They're burning out. One in three are looking for jobs right now. And people are actively asking, what's your tech stack? And making decisions about which companies to join based on the tech that they've got access to and or the budget that they're going to get for better tech.
That's an interesting finding, wasn't it? I mean, for people who don't know, this was Madeline, like, was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she's like such an important figure in our industry, I think, because she provides like a pretty rare service, which is studying the market. There's only like a cluster of them, a handful of people that do this type of analysis, focusing on TA tech. And she's like a must follow person as far as I'm concerned. But that report was great. It was focusing on our relationship, our recruit, us recruiters, what's our relationship with TA technology? What do we care about? What do we use? And how do we think about, you know, new opportunities in terms of the provision of technology that's there? And as you say, Adam, I think the stuff that you're using is either an incentive or a deterrent to your value proposition to these recruiters that are now obviously in super high demand.
If you're going and joining a company that's got bad technology or no appreciation that recruitment technology is important, you're being set up to fail and your career is going to stagnate because you're not going to be up to date with the best way of doing things.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, this is very much, developers have always felt this way. One of the key questions is, what is the tech environment? What are you using? Because, you know, I totally get it. The job's great. I like you. But if you're asking me to drive this particular car, which I know is a bad car, I don't want to do that. It's going to impact my enjoyment of the job and, in fact, my ability to perform because I know this is not the optimal tool. So I think it's a bit of a wake-up call, isn't it, for companies that maybe have just got away with some like old school stuff that, or maybe in some cases, not no tech at all, when, you know, really now is the moment to really digitize your process and bring in some new kit, really.
Yep. The next one I want to draw everybody's attention to is Glassdoor's Best Places to Work.
Yep.
The most interesting thing about this is I looked at the top 10 employers and every single one of them is hiring what I would call in-demand talent. I think 8 of the top 10 are primarily technology companies. And then one was McKinsey, which of course is hiring in-demand talent, very technical skill sets and very hard to reach on the experienced hire side. And one was Abcam, which is medical tech,
yeah,
effectively. So, you know, and so that's effectively another tech business. I think the next 10 were overwhelmingly tech or certainly tech engineering type businesses. And it's not that surprising that they feel like they've got to work a bit harder to hire the best people and retain the best people. Now, of course, things have changed in the last year in that maybe the less qualified type jobs like lorry driver or that type of thing is now today's in-demand talent, but it doesn't mean that tech's not in-demand talent. It just means that there's a lot more in-demand talent than there ever was. The results from this will really be from the first half, the second half of 2020, the first half of 2021. So,
did you see the report? Was it the for the UK? I think was it the Labour something? Some service that no, it was on LinkedIn actually. Like they tried to track which were the high growth jobs in the UK for the last 12 months. Obviously, I had a Brexit joke on that because the highest growing job was like customs officer. And I think number 3 was import specialist or something. So there's like red tape job growth. Brilliant. But there was also other roles. Like technology is always in the top 10 because no matter what is going on, people are looking to recruit people, these technical skills to essentially digitize their businesses. We've been talking about this forever. But it's almost like there's no way to be a laggard there anymore. Like this can't be a low priority for you to do or something you can just push off to next year. This is like a top priority. Any like manual analog process that you're currently operating in, that's going to people are going to start thinking, look, can I write a bit of software to sort this out? Can I automate this process? It's going to be high demand for software people for a foreseeable, I should imagine.
Yeah. Connor's asked if there's any trend on private versus public companies in the list, and so they're all private sector, yeah, rather than public sector. But if you mean listed or privately held, it's a mixture. But I think about 3/4 of the top 10 are listed, like NASDAQ. There was a lot of things like ServiceNow. I think was actually number 1. Adobe was on there. VMware was on there, ARM was on there, that type of thing.
It's quite useful as a tool. Like I say, I think a lot of people are rightly skeptical of the value of like self-reported reviews, for instance. I think our good friend Bill Bowman said it perfectly well. I still quote him on this. It's like anybody who writes an online review is an extremist. You're either someone who's just like massively enthusiastic about the employer, or you're an antagonist, like a dissatisfied leaver. And you're trying to throw your ex-employer under the bus. But most people in the middle will not write a report, and that's probably the more honest view. But at the same time, it's still useful to see sort of how different companies are being scored, particularly in the different categories that Glassdoor put out. So, you know, it's definitely worth checking out. It's a curiosity. And you also got to be aware that irrespective of what you think about the validity of these reports, people do still check Glassdoor. Job seekers do look at it. So if you're up there, you need to understand what is being said about you. So share the link in the chat stream there. So make sure you go ahead and check it out. The best places to work 2022.
Yeah, no, people definitely check it out. And I think Bill is right. It is mostly extremists who actually take the time to fill in reviews of things on sites like that. But I mean, most people are probably immune to it or understand this. So if you go onto like a restaurant site, I don't know, TripAdvisor or something, and you go look up a restaurant or a location or something like that, and you see 10 reviews and three of them say this place is absolutely terrible, never go, and the other seven are like good to excellent, then you're probably going to go with the majority and go, yes, let's give it a go.
Yeah, it's true. I think that we're all a bit cynical now. We all kind of get it. We're not naively accepting the review, and we're kind of trying to read between the lines. You're absolutely right. I'm thinking about even online purchasing, like you're buying something on Amazon or something. You're looking at the reviews, and of course, there's going to be a zero-star review. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be an Aston Martin, like off the factory or whatever. Somebody's going to stick one star against it. But at the same time, you just like weigh the balance of it and then get a feel. And the ones that actually have more commentary are the ones you pay more attention to, because you forget less about the scoring and more about actually this person has taken the time to break it down and give some commentary. Let's read about this, and maybe that's something to keep an eye out on. So yeah,
I love the thought of like small town. There's two hotels in the town, and there's one guy who owns one hotel, and he's like, like the husband and wife own the hotel, and they're like in the back room getting their kids and their granny and whatever, like writing bad reviews for the other hotel. I think you get caught for that, but
it's actually defamatory, isn't it? So all of these review sites, depending on where you're at in the world, but I think in the UK definitely you can't defame people like this.
Sick giving bad software reviews of your competition or bad Glassdoor reviews.
You know, you're gonna have to like outsource that, multiple times to create some clear distance between you and the review. Okay, cool. One more, mate, before we get on with this.
Right. Greg Savage's article about this will help you make more placements. And effectively, right, I think what it was saying was focus on SMEs rather than the great big corporates. Yes. And I do agree with that, and I agree with some of the reasons he said, but I've actually got my own reasons for thinking this is a good idea. So the first thing is, if you want to know what it's like to work at Barclays, it takes you about 5 seconds to go and look at people's LinkedIn profiles and look at Glassdoor and things like that. If you want to know what it's like to work at John Fulton Plumbers, you've never heard of John Fulton Plumbers. You don't know that it's a great little business with 60 people a mile from your house, and it's going to take somebody actually actively giving you the information so that you know what the culture is like, because it might not be online anywhere. You might not be able to find anything out about it. So self-directed research for SMEs is much harder than it is for like big stock market listed companies. So recruitment consultants have therefore got a lot more that they can sell. They've got a lot more up their sleeve. They've got a lot more gold that they can offer. And they can't really offer that much gold to the candidate about, like, do you want to work at Barclays? The candidate knows what it's like to work at Barclays or not. And the other thing is, the employer, Barclays are going to be filling 99.9% of their own jobs. So going and targeting Barclays to get onto their PSL for a 5% fee is probably not that worth it. Whereas becoming the specialist and working with companies of up to 400 people or something like that is a really good idea. So good article.
He's got another article in is going in this week as well. I think Greg has like got his content game on point. So Greg Savage, for people who don't know him, he's a South African recruiter, but based in Australia, and he does a lot of coaching for sort of recruitment agencies. He wrote, I thought, a really useful, practical, and insightful post last week about what type of clients are now to be considered. Your top tier clients to try and get instead of these cool brands, he's saying. What you need to shoot for is brands where there is, as you say, Adam, like a bit of an EB gap, and that's where the agencies can take on the added value role. I thought it was really quite interesting. I think Greg's angle is also the fact that, you know, some of these big brands might be carrying a lot of brand baggage,
and
exactly. So maybe companies or candidates have a different view as to what they want now, be sensitive to these, consumer sort of trends that we're seeing, candidates wanting to work for more responsible companies, less carbon sort of intensive organizations. Maybe we don't want to work for an ad tech company. Maybe we don't want to work for a bank or a mining organization or whatever it is. As an agency, maybe it makes sense to target those types of different types of sectors and companies in those places in order to represent those. So I thought quite a smart way to think around that. Anyway, let's talk about this topic, how to set salary for remote teams. I want to get your thoughts on this, Adam, because you're actually a practitioner in this space, even though it may be currently different, but it might actually change significantly for you, because you basically had an on-site team in office that then moved entirely remote. And now I guess they're recruiting people irrespective of location. What have you done in terms of, like, is there an official policy, or is it a case where the company's small enough where you could sort of just get away with, doing it a little bit more ad hoc? How did you kind of manage the situation?
No, you have to have an active plan around why you're doing what you're doing. And I believe that your company's, if you're a recruitment agency business, then your company's strategy is wrapped up in all of this around where are we going to have people and what are we going to do. If you're an employer that doesn't do recruitment, as your core business model, then you might have to really kind of stick to a policy that HR is setting for you. But my thinking is that two things you need to consider are, should we be paying somebody in the Philippines this exactly the same as we're paying somebody in Manhattan? And there's so many challenges with that. The concept, you also need to think about the concept of, like, have you got an active strategy around geo arbitrage? So have you got a history of offshoring and north shoring and things like that? If you have, why would you change that? There's lots of different reasons why you might and why you might not. But I can tell you what we've done in our company. Of course, my company's not really recruiters. Although we're in the industry, there's not very many actual people recruiting in the business. But what we did was we, went to work from home in March 2020. And we've surveyed our people right throughout the pandemic. And we made a decision in November that we were going to give anybody who wants to work from home a £100 a month allowance for buying stuff that they need to work from home, such as their internet, additional electricity, things like that. And we were giving everybody access to the office as well during Q1. And at the end of March, everybody's going to get the opportunity to either continue to take the work from home allowance or choose the office. And depending on how many people choose the office or not, that'll make an impact as to what type of office accommodation we have as of April. So we've also, although we're allowing people to work from anywhere, all of our hiring is in and around Glasgow, and that's very deliberate because in all hands on a Monday morning, the banter is all about what happened in the football, what happened in the restaurants over the weekend, what happens around Glasgow, and the rapport that you can maintain with people when you talk the same, you know about the same things is a benefit to a company of our size. Although I've been in lots of meetings with people based all over the world, and it's a lot of fun to find out from them what's going on where they live as well. But that's the decision that we've made for now.
You know what? That's actually a really interesting angle for another topic. Does it actually make sense to hire people that have the same cultural conversations? Because that's almost like free or easy way to build relationships. Because as you say, everyone's got these shared experiences of being in the same, in your case, the same city. So it's not so much of a time zone thing per se. It's not about, it's not about physical proximity per se. It's about the fact that they're having access to the same bits of information so that you can build team rapidly. That's actually a really interesting concept.
It's partially that, but just to add to that, the physical proximity has got another benefit, and that is like on Monday, we're all going out into the sorting office, like the distribution office for a local charity, and we're sorting through all the donations to put some on the side which can go in the shops to be sold, and some which are, that's not really good for selling. And, you know, we're all getting together to do that together. So Adam, yes, does the team still meet up for social events outside of work? Various things about that. Every team manager is encouraged to get their team together in person when they feel like it would be beneficial to do so. We did a Christmas party together, and probably about once a quarter we get together to do something social, and about once a quarter we get together for like a team volunteering day, something like that as well. So, yeah.
I think that this is a fascinating journey. So we're going to spend a bit more time, maybe in a future show, really diving deep into this. I mean, maybe we don't want to make you as the only commentator, but you've raised a few interesting. Yeah. Got to keep your chat to a minimum, yes. Adam, to be fair. We'll dive into that. One question, though, before I bring our guests on. What happens when you hire someone that is outside of the space? The company grows to whatever degree. There's a brilliant person that they are in the Philippines, let's say, or they are in, Hong Kong or whatever it is. They're in a different country. What policy do you have? Do you have like a universal like a pay grade, or are you going to location adjust? How are you going to do that?
We've got a team of, we work with a partner company in Chennai, and we have 8 software developers who work for us there. And the reason we do that, quite honestly, is because it would be far too expensive for us to have 8 additional software developers based in Glasgow. And so, as I understand, we're paying them just slightly above average for an outsourcing, arrangement. And the people there are getting paid, well above average for the kind of local currency differences. We haven't had any, we're 22 people, and we haven't in the main business, and we haven't had any need to go outside of the west of Scotland. There's 1 million people in and around Glasgow, and most of the jobs we hire for are jobs, a lot of them are in customer success. There's nobody in any company that has done a customer success job for a business like ours before. So we have to hire for potential for most of those jobs anyway. So
that's another pathway for people, isn't it? Like people are struggling to recruit, and you've got to think, hang on, is it because you're very locked into like prior experience or domain knowledge that you think is essential? But in fact, maybe it isn't.
Rosa's behaviors.
Need to invest more in the trajectory of the person. Yeah. And the capacity to learn. But that's really interesting. So basically you're saying we haven't made that decision, but if you would actually factor in location as a big factor there, because what was interesting in the poll I ran, I don't know whether anybody took part in this, but 1,000 people voted, and the vast majority of people said, two-thirds of the people said, actually, you should pay only for the job universally. So there's no location input in the job. If the job is worth this to the company, you should be paid that. It doesn't matter whether you're in Timbuktu, Doesn't matter whether you're in Mountain View, doesn't matter whether you're in Alaska, it would be at that rate. I was surprised at that because I was thinking, generally speaking, no company's going to do that. You are definitely going to location adjust.
There's a difference in attitude towards that if you're a recruiter or you're a business like founder, because you've got to balance the cost of doing all the different things that you need to get done. Yeah. And you work out every way of doing it and you hack it. You have to hack every single way of getting the job done. So there's a lot of conflicting priorities, and sometimes you are going to need to take advantage of the fact that things can get done less expensively in other locations. The same reason we get a lot of things made in China, the same reason.
It's exactly how business works. I mean, you can't overpay deliberately because you'd be less competitive as a business. And if you're less competitive, basically means you're going to get less customers because someone else can outcompete you at price at the very least. And it's going to be very difficult for you to survive in long term. So I think there's a lot of well-meaning sort of behavior and attitudes, but it doesn't really connect with reality in my view. It's like, okay, this will only last until this physically connects with how it works in reality. Business doesn't work that way. So
but what one thing that I wouldn't do, though, actually, I have never thought about this, but if somebody in my team said, right, I've decided I'm going to move to Brazil because I want to go, I don't know, surfing like every evening, I'm not going to start paying them an adjusted wage because I think that the quality of the cost of living is completely different in Brazil. So that, I wouldn't go, right, okay, you're going to earn less.
You might have
in that case, why wouldn't I hire somebody there on a UK salary? There's a lot of things to think about in that.
I think you have to. I think if someone decided, this is what you'd call, geographical arbitrage. If you pay people this salary in an expensive city, they say, that's great, but actually we're remote. I'm off to, Tulum in Mexico or something. I'm going to do it up from a beach. Totally can deliver the job on a beach, but do it at a very low cost of living, and they're living like a king out there. It's like, okay, maybe you do have to adjust the rate. Because if you're saying let's pay universally, companies are doing that. I mean, to answer the question for Barbara, there are some companies that have said we're going to pick our most expensive place, and that's going to be how we're going to anchor the salary. So for example, Basecamp have said they're going to pay all of their engineers as if they were living in San Francisco. So you can imagine how expensive all their engineers are going to be.
But you're going to have to compete. How can you compete? Well,
they'll attract a lot of talent. But what's going to happen is you're going to get someone who's living in a country that is far cheaper that will have an outrageously high salary. But whether that's a good or bad thing, I don't know. This is what we're going to talk about. Okay, let's bring on some of our guests and figure this out because we're not experts at this. But we have a few people that are. And we're going to see whether they can help us. So Rachel Gibbs, I'm going to bring her on.
When I said there, how can you compete? They're thinking about it. I think actually what I really meant was, how can you compete if you're hiring people in Silicon Valley or in San Francisco, to be honest, the cost technologists there?
But definitely not. What's going to happen is you're going to be basically, there'll be job flight. Why would you want to live in a place that is expensive? You can earn a decent amount of money in a cheaper place and have a better standard of living. So, okay, let's say hello to our guests. So firstly, we'll say hi to Andrew. Great to see you, Andrew. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you and what it is you do?
Hi, Andrew Godomsky. I'm a managing director of Aspen Analytics, and we're a people analytics and human capital consulting company based out of the U.S.
Fantastic. And we see Rachel Gibbs there as well. Rachel, good to see you. Can you quickly introduce yourself, who you
Hi,
are,
I'm what you do? Thank you. I'm Rachel Gibbs. I'm an independent freelance compensation and benefits advisor based out of Switzerland.
Fantastic. And finally, I think we have Megan there. Megan, great to see you. For the people who don't know you, can you quickly introduce yourself? Who are you and what it is you do?
Sure. My name is Megan O'Malley. I'm the global head of recruiting for an international NGO called International Rescue Committee.
Fantastic. And all of you have got like some really interesting angles or experience or thoughts on this challenge that we have. Now, before we kick off, I just wanted to share with you some of the results from this survey that I ran on LinkedIn prior to this conversation. And I wanted you to have a think about this because I was surprised at the results. And I was also a little bit surprised at the commentary in the poll. So let me just share this with you. I wonder whether I could share screen here. I might take a risk and do that. And we could just study it. Give me a sec. I'll try and share screen at high risk. Share screen. Boom. Never done this before. Okay. So you see my screen, okay, everybody?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. It says here salary for remote only teams, yada, yada, yada. And we're saying what best describes your current position for remote worker compensation? And 67% have said pay according to job. So that is not location adjusted. That's saying, you know what, that job is worth this to this amount of company, irrespective of where that job's located, we are going to pay this number. Only 21% said we're going to pay location adjusted. 9% said don't know. And then there was a commentary, like there was a percentage of people said, I don't know. And of course, we have a long list there. I'm going to share this link for everybody so you know what's going on and you can actually go ahead and talk to people there. But I wanted to get your view on, let's stop sharing here, on that poll. Like, what do you think that's saying and is that realistic? Go to you firstly, Andrew.
I think I can appreciate that people say, hey, we should pay based on the job. My first perspective is, are they just assuming then that we're just going to pay the highest amount? So I think there's an assumption laid into that answer saying, well, we're just going to pay whatever the value is. Well, what if the valuation is a lot less to the organization? So the people who are earning a high wage, are they just going to earn a low wage now?
All right. So that's a really important point. They've made a presumption to say I'm on this money right now because I live in an expensive city. Why? I might decide to live in a seaside. I don't want to see my salary go down. But what you're saying is actually what is the worth of the job if you're truly recruiting from remote? Like, how do you set that number? I think Barbara mentioned it in the chat stream there. Like, how do we actually evaluate the job if we take a truly global view and we apply market forces to it? You know, who is competent to do the job and who's interested to do the job, we can expect the wage depression, can't we? So yeah, very good point. If we're paying universally, maybe the salary goes down. Does that change your vote? Your thoughts on the poll and that conversation thread, Rachel? I think you read some of the commentary there. So I wonder what your thoughts are on why people have made that sort of the distribution on the polling and what you think their thought process is.
I think, like Andrew, people are taking kind of their view into account. But as we've already explored, companies are looking at it in a slightly different viewpoint. I use a lot of market data that I'm getting from agencies, special agencies, specialist agencies, and other organisations are looking to recruiters for salary information and for market trends. And those are really what are informing. So you've kind of got two different perspectives or two different outlooks. One is what the employee is seeing, and then the other is what the company is seeing. And unfortunately, the company has the better knowledge base, really, because they can afford it.
That's very interesting. Megan, from a hiring manager point of view, where you've got a global team, so you know these are all over in different places. How has that informed your attitude to what sort of pay strategy needs to be operating in your business or in your organization, should I say?
Yeah, in our organization, we pay locally to the local market based on cost of labor in the local market. However, it is a humanitarian organization with also some people who are former business people in it. So we do end up in this conversation philosophically quite a bit, where particularly humanitarians who say, we should pay the same for that job, whether it's in New York or Nairobi. And to Andrew's point, we say, well, okay, if you're going to make a global scale, then what does that do to the person in New York? It rises the person in Nairobi. But currently, we pay to the market based on cost of labor.
Yeah, That's really interesting. Do you, so open question to everyone here. Do you anticipate that to be the default position? And companies like Basecamp, who have said, look, we're paying everyone at San Francisco rate, as being an outlier. Do you expect that to be, you know, a certain way of paying to be more or less the standard and what have you?
Well, I think to Adam's point, how do you stay competitive? What does it do to your, either your profit or your funding management if you pay either to a global standard or to a kind of highest market standard? And then how do you compete financially?
Yeah, Megan,
quickly ask Megan, the jobs that you hire in your organization, are they jobs that have to be based in a particular location, or some of those jobs can be based in lots of different places? Right.
It's a mix. So some of the jobs have to be there, and some can be anywhere.
Okay. In that case, have you got a location based like strategy? So for example, if I can get 10 qualified people based in Nairobi, that's better than having 10 qualified people in New York City, because it's obviously going to be a quarter of the cost or whatever. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. But there are certain roles that are global anyway. They're above a certain limit, a level, sorry. You're hiring globally across, and those market, that market's more or less a global market. It's really more at the junior level, and in the less specialist areas that you have more differentiation by location.
I mean, it's a very different salary if you're talking about an expert in Islamabad or an expert in New York. It's a very different salary. It could be a half or a third.
Well, and there's certainly, you can certainly look at trades as an example, and you say, well, what's the cost of someone who has a skilled trade, say an electrician, someone who is executing that in South Africa versus, say, France versus the UK versus Nairobi. And what ends up happening is that person has to be local. You know, so you're not phoning that in. You're on the ground. And same with healthcare workers or people who work on oil rigs and so on. And so there has to be this pay adjusted by location, but I think it's related to the specific location. Then there's this concept of, we have knowledge workers who can probably work from anywhere, but they probably live in certain places, and they're probably living in those certain places that are convenient for, say, time zones. So Adam, I love your example of Brazil. So it's like, okay, well, if a person lives in Brazil or they live in New York, but they're in the same time zone, or they're only one time zone off, should we pay them the same?
Yeah, right. So South Africa is a good example of that as well. That's why a lot of UK outsourcing companies have got call centers in South Africa. Same time zone, right. Much less expensive.
That's right. That's what ends up happening is, I think location is kind of, for larger organizations or global organizations or companies that want to get the funding and scale, candidly, they're going to be executing on location adjusted. I think the idea of Basecamp, as an example, we'll use that. I think that's an excellent way to try to acquire talent. I think that'd be very hard for them to take on huge equity stake and then say, oh, we're going to just go ahead and do that times 1,000. I think that would be a difficult sell in their pitch deck.
I think you're right, but it also gives them a competitive edge in attracting people. And it also meets many ESG qualities or issues around that, which are highly attractive to employees beyond salary, those other broader elements as well. So it has that advantage.
I do think Basecamp's going to have to be really diligent about performance management, because paying that sort of premium salary in cheaper locations potentially might incent people to stay for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
How do we deal with the, I mean, this is all really interesting. A couple of points that have been raised already, which I didn't think about, but there may be like a segmentation within your employee population of people who are fixed in the location. Like, for instance, they actually need to be physically in a particular spot to do the job. That has to be location adjusted, surely. But then there's this other population which may be location agnostic, in the sense that they could be in there, but it doesn't really matter. In which case, are we possibly talking about different ways to pay, like two different policies of within the same company, basically? Adam, you're nodding your head vigorously there. So you're very, go on.
So fortunate, I'm in a spot where I get to see a lot of payrolls. And so I think one of the ways that some companies have executed this is they've indicated these are jobs where we pay more within the same grade. So for example, some companies are very focused on technology or engineering. And so what they do is you might have someone who's a level 7, but they receive an additional pay bump because they're in that function of technology or engineering. And so then you have that differential. I'm a grade 7, but I'm a tech grade 7. So I get more because it's critical to the organization. They're harder to find, whatever the rules are. At the same time, we then have people who are sometimes exempt or non-exempt. So people are eligible for overtime or they're not. And so we already segment. We already do a lot of things related to this. And I think that sometimes we kind of get a little focused in on what about me? But there could be 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 people who are also getting paid at the company. And it is actually cut up a lot more than I think people think. And so we do this anyway. We already come up with rules and we execute this pretty regularly, I think, more than people know.
Okay, let's talk about this scenario because I think it will happen, right? You've got an in-person company. Everyone's paid a certain rate because, you know what, they're all rolling into the office. Actually, no, we've shifted to remote only. Everyone's working from wherever they want. And then you get a bunch of people decide, okay, great, I'm off to Marbella or something, or I'm going to Tahiti. What do you do with those folks? Like, do you maintain the salary there? Or do you say, actually, you know, you got 6 months and then we're going to do a location adjustment to you downwards? Thoughts on this? I mean, is there a policy there as an example?
If it's Marbella, their salary would need to go up.
Yeah, it's a bad example, man. I was just thinking anywhere where the beach is cheap, but that's obviously nonsense.
That's not. Puerto Banus is not cheap.
You can have the even more accentuated problem, which is where somebody moves to Marbella and they're sitting alongside Spanish teams and there's a fundamental difference across the salaries within the same country because of the remote element. I think the companies who are able to get on top of this are looking at either sort of a transfer, a period of smoothing to be aware of this fairness and to make this work, really, because it's a huge risk from a fairness perspective that they need to consider.
That's a really important point. Like, let's say you have a hub someplace, that's often a time, sort of an opportunity for people to cycle into different sort of spaces. Oh, you're living here, but you're carrying a San Francisco salary to Lisbon or something. You know, that's like times three, maybe. That's extraordinary, right? I mean, that's going to be, you can't have that person sit next to people doing the same job. So, you know, that is fascinating. And Pavania, thank you so much for sharing that. She's from remote.com. That's a super interesting. Geo pay ranges seem to be the thing. What about sort of this phenomena of people moving after the rate's been set? I mean, have you any sort of live experience of that? Megan, I'm going to you particularly with this. I wonder whether that's been within your experiences of a business, or have people more or less kind of been pretty committed to their location, even though, you know, it's a geographically distributed?
We've had a lot of people move over the last couple of years, but we will be doing an adjustment. And I think we're probably not alone, regardless of for-profit or not-for-profit. We will be doing an adjustment. Now, you know, to the earlier discussion, we have some people where you can't move, your job's on the ground. But for those who are flexible, we've had a lot of people move, or for political reasons. We have staff in Afghanistan and places like that. People have moved and we will have to adjust.
How do you, this is an internal communications challenge, because making the adjustment, realistically, I can't see any reason why you would make the adjustment other than to save the organization money. So, but you can't really communicate it quite like that, I don't think, because that's a very brutal way of doing it. So what do you say?
This is when I'm happy I'm not in the compensation team.
Sure. It's a challenge.
But I, you know,
okay.
I think
what would Rachel say then?
Yeah. So do you have somebody sitting next to them, right? Like, who moves and is sitting next to them? And because the person started working in, I don't know where, they're at a disadvantage versus the person who moves to there.
Good point. Yeah.
Sorry, I interrupted.
I think it's just what you said, which is that, and you make, if you have the policy, and it's transparent, it's much easier to have those adult conversations with people and explain why the adjustment's necessary. And if you smooth it, it's never welcome, but people, if they understand the rationale, it makes it easier for them.
I think it's all about the policy, isn't it? Can I just ask a quick question? As a guesstimate, how many companies do you think have that policy of we're going to location adjust you down if you move around? Like, I think that's a vanishingly small number, right? I think there's a lot of companies that literally have not even thought about this, and they're just going to encounter a scenario, probably be case-based, where there is going to be someone who's like highly paid sitting next to someone who is paid less, and it'll just emerge as a problem, and they'll just have they'll have a policy after that problem's blown up in their faces. What are your thoughts on this? Is it a common thing to have this policy, and if not, shouldn't we be banging the drum that they should?
I think the policy actually exists in some of the larger public players or global players. I think the transparency on the policy and how it's been disclosed to the employee population, that doesn't happen as often as you think. The U.S. government, as an example, does actually a pretty good job of being transparent. You can download all the pay ranges for all 53 regions in the United States and how much get people paid and all the differentials. But the average U.S. employee, do they know? They have to look it up. I mean, it's not like they're tweeting it every 3 minutes and saying, oh, by the way, this is what everybody gets paid. And they're a pretty good example of transparency. Most organizations have some sort of level of policy because they have global payrolls. They just don't share it candidly.
So New York City just passed a rule, to have all salary ranges on posting. So I do think that's going to push the U.S. generally. Right before this call, I was just working on an offer for someone who were moving from Salt Lake City to DC, and we're giving her a substantial increase, right? Because she's going from one market to the next. So it does go both ways.
Let's talk about the transparency angle. Is that a benefit or a negative, or is it an additional management problem for a manager dealing with remote pay? Does it help that it's like completely transparent, or is it sometimes an aid to have it not as transparent as that?
I think it's going to be tough. I think it's going to be really tough. In our environment, some of our jobs are based on grants and very restricted funding, right? So where it will be easy is when we hire someone and we say, we're going to pay you, 20 pounds and 56 pence per hour, and we don't have any more to pay you. So that's what we're paying you. That's easy, right? There is no negotiation. For jobs that are more flexible and negotiable, it's going to be really tough, and it's going to be hard on the managers.
I think the other thing is that, and there's certainly the opportunity to have more than one job available. You have a parking spot, but there's more than one way to fill that parking spot. And so some companies, some agencies are starting to execute. You can work anywhere, but you'll be assigned to a location and your pay is based on the location. If you want to work in Florida, you can work in Florida, but you'll make Florida pay. If you want to work in DC, you'll be DC pay. But what that also means is occasionally you have to show up in a DC office or a Florida office. And so I think we're starting to see some changes on how a manager is going to make a decision about the type of team he or she is going to manage, where they're going to locate, and then they're going to make adjustments based on pay.
Yeah, very, very interesting.
So you're in Aruba and your office is in DC, and you're getting your boss, hey, 20 minutes, meet you in the office. Like, what the? How am I going to get there? Damn it, they don't know.
That's actually a legitimate question.
On the beach. Shut up.
That is a legitimate question. How are you actually going to tell? Are we going to do things like IP tracking and stuff like this? Because if I'm remote and I can say, sure, Andrew, I'm in DC. Actually, no, I'm in Mexico. Like, what? How are you going to know? I mean, I could just fake the background. I could do anything. So
would be extreme rather than just tell your boss I'm going to Mexico for a month.
No, but what I'm saying is you could lie about it. And I think the incentive is to lie. So are we now saying that we do actually need surveillance technology to really track where people are?
Wearables.
And make sure...
We already have it, though. Already have it. So if you're in a global organization, your VPN and your remote access is already set up by location anyway. So when I log into any one of these machines that we've got here, they know that I'm in the East Coast time zone. I'm in New Jersey or I'm by New York, because I can't log into the one in Brazil. I can't log into the one in Mexico. We forget that IT has done a pretty good job with remote access. They know where we are already, especially in the larger organizations.
I think that's a larger organization experience, because in a smaller organization that's gone remote only, like say Adam's business, I mean, it's different because he's in sort of, everyone's in Glasgow, but I can totally imagine a situation of a company of that size, 50 people, whatever, maybe everything's on the cloud, you're kind of using consumer level tech and stuff like that. You're getting away with that. Recruitment agencies in particular, like you don't necessarily need heavyweight technology to run a recruiting business. You might be chasing your staff around trying to figure out where they are.
Where's the line, right? Where's the line, right? Like I have recruiters who, I have one who lives in Florida, but her mom lives in Cairo. And sometimes I'll look out the window and it's dark and I'll say, where are you? And she says, I'm in Cairo. I'm like, all right.
I want to hear from the audience on this. So what are your thoughts on, everyone hates surveillance tech. I mean, apart from me, actually, surveillance tech is fine. You can't trust people. Of course you can't. What are you talking about? Let's be honest. Everyone is an individual optimizer. We all take advantage when we can. If we can get away with it, we will do. Let's just like stop being childish and thinking, oh yeah, well, everyone's a good person. Everyone optimizes for their value if they can get away with it. So if that's the case and you're an employer, is it so bad to be able to track where people are? Why is that terrible thing? So I've been endorsing this. By the way, I know some minority opinions. If you want to flame me on it, go ahead.
It's a matter of opinion. Yeah, really.
You can flame me on it. I don't care. But the point of the matter is, does this now actually make it like very important for a business to employ this technology?
It's entirely cultural. It's entirely cultural.
There are tax implications that companies need to know where employees are located for permanent establishment rules. And if they can't tell where people are, they've got potential risks from Cairo, for instance. I don't like surveillance, but I can see why a company might do it.
All right, so that's an interesting angle. Let's lean in on that for a little while, because I hadn't even thought about that. But it seems to me we need to be very aware. This is a compliance issue. So someone's saying they're actually based in Spain, but they're not. They're based in, I don't know, Armenia or some other place. There is a tax implication. Company's got a problem because... like, how do we pay? How do we do whatever? What is exactly that problem, Rachel? Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
If the company is deemed to be trading in another location because the employee is working from there, the employee has tax and social security potentially issues around that. The employer has as well. And then the risk is a permanent establishment, like a business being set up in Armenia. And it gets really complex. And
is that not just... Yeah. Isn't that just directly linked to the employee's residence, though? I mean, you've got to say, I live in Armenia, or I live in... You've got to pay local taxes. You've got to have local national insurances and things like that. You can't just go and live in Armenia.
The employer has to be, or should be, a registered employer, particularly in highly socialized countries. So think about France, right? Someone lies, they're actually working in France. Let's say it's a woman. She then gets pregnant. She goes for her health services. They say, who's your employer? She says, ABC company. They say, ABC company is not a registered employer here. You're not paying into their systems. That employer is now in trouble.
But that's exactly what
you need
to
have what's known as a...
You can't just go and live and work anywhere you like. You've got to...
But legally you can't do that. But de facto you can. That's what we're trying to get to, Adam. It's possible
The employer has to have what's called a nexus. So they have to have a location that's registered inside a country, or in the United States, they have to have them in states. And it's not, and same thing in a number of other countries that have localized jurisdictions. You have to have a nexus because of the taxes. But then the other issue are things like insurances or board certifications. In the United States, as an example, one of the big debates right now is, can you do mental health via remote outside of your state, because people are only certified to practice psychology inside, like, say, California, but can they actually give medical advice to someone who's not in California regularly because they're monitored by the board in California? Those types of issues in trades and skills go all over the world. And so we need to really think about the location of where our people work because of their certifications, their skill sets, and then, you know, oversight that protects a lot of people.
That changes the entire digital nomadism, like, ideal, doesn't it? Because, you know, I've got a few friends right now that are in caravans, for instance. Hi, Caroline. I hope you're all right. I haven't heard from her for a while. I hope she is actually all right. But she's in a caravan. And it's like, okay, if there is, like, legal problems with her deploying her services in a certain state, and she is in the United States, then... Well, she needs to stop working, right? She needs to, like, drive through that state and not do that job while she's there. She has to move through it.
Well, and it depends. I mean, malpractice is a great example. You know, what if you were working remote and you scripted, but you were out of state, and then there was a lawsuit? You may not be covered by malpractice insurance because you weren't registered to actually practice medicine in another state. There's all kinds of rules like that that I think that. The pandemic has opened this box about remote work and our ability to retain talent, get talent, change the way we pay them. But there's infrastructure behind it that has been laid in for a long time. Yeah. And those are the things that are really starting to bubble up.
So what you are saying there, Andrew, is that we're basically probably going to encounter quite a number of very interesting cases coming up. As we've done 6 months, 12 months, 18 months of remote, there's going to be episodes where things have happened and then suddenly we'll think, oh my goodness, we never thought about this. This is a problem. Okay, let's take a quick break because basically we always do this at the middle of the show. Folks, please don't allow this amazing conversation to be the only time you talk about this. It is obviously super, super important. Let's not make Brain Food Live a bottleneck for this. So if you want to connect with everyone else who's watching the show, connect with the panelists, connect with whoever you're interacting with in the chat, take a moment and share your LinkedIn into the chat stream now and just spend a minute just to connect with everybody there. We're all interested in this challenge of how do you play a remotely distributed team. If you want to talk to anybody else who's also thinking along these lines and having these issues, go ahead and connect with those folks. Make sure you continue the conversation and not allow Brain Food Live to be a bottleneck. Okay, cool. So very, very interesting. Let's move it to, oh, by the way, as a final thing on this, if there's any questions for any of the guests, make sure you use the ask a question section. We're going to get to that in a minute. There's already two questions there, but make sure you populate that with the questions you have, and we'll take it up from there. Talk to me about pensions and stuff like this. Is that a problem? I don't have a pension. At least I've forgotten about it. So I don't even know. But is it located? Does it change if I'm moving around? What's going on with that? Thoughts?
Really complex.
Well, I mean, yeah. No, please go ahead.
No, it's fine.
I think it depends. So sometimes pension is determined based on usually not just how long you've been with the organization, but actually the salary that you were earning in the last several years prior to your retirement. And so, as an example, if you were to say move from New York to Dallas, and your pay cut, you were to experience a pay cut with that move, and then you were to retire, in theory, your pension should be based on your Dallas salary, not what you were earning in New York, because they go back to where you last usually earned. And so there's things like that that kind of play at this. And I think that people tend to forget that when they're looking at retirement and they're thinking about where they're going to locate.
So I think optimizing, go ahead, Meg.
I was just going to say, I think it depends country by country and what sort of contract you're on as well, right? We have a lot of expats, so they are all on an international pension plan. So they can be in, we put them in South Sudan, and then we put them in Ethiopia, and then we put them in Afghanistan. It's the same pension. It's fine. But even myself, when I lived in London, I had a British pension plan. Will I ever see that money? Do I have any idea as to how to ever get that back? No, really.
I can no. Tell you, and I was going to tell Hung as well.
You there need we go. Thank you.
You need Pension B, right? Okay. It's just a little app that finds you and
roll
brings them all together. Yeah.
There we go. There we go. See, I learned something today. But anyway, a lot of it's country based.
So hang on, going on to this idea of like maybe pegged to your last salary, it kind of makes sense to opt, if you're going to do it, to completely optimize, you might want to like spend a bit of time in Aruba for a middle part of your career, but then go to an expensive place where you get paid a higher salary in order to check out on a higher pension plan, right? And then go back to Aruba once you retire.
It could work. It sounds like it needs an enormous amount of tax planning or pension planning to make it work. And the other element, of course, is social security pension elements, which you can protect. When you leave the UK, for instance, you can usually kind of port those or continue contributing. But again, it's a really complex area, and I don't think there's one solution to it all. But you need specialist advice, but it is possible.
Okay, let's move on to some advice to companies that have, you know, just dreaming about this for the first time. They're just, you know, going to run into this. What sort of like principal position, like, what sort of like basic baseline position can they take? Like, what are the options? I think you can go universal pay. That is simple in some respects because it can remove a lot of these like, you know, localization problems you have, but obviously it's going to be super expensive. And you're making like a mega commitment that you just may feel weird. As Michael, I think, said in the chat there, how many companies actually have the revenue of Basecamp that they can get away with paying, you know, 300 grand for an engineer, no matter where they live? I mean, probably not many. So it's suitable for only certain types of companies, but it is one strategy you can use. A second strategy is location adjusted. So you're going to just go figure out what the pay is for that particular job in a location and say, right, if you're based there, that's how it's going to be done. How does that work when you're people are pressuring for salary transparency and stuff like this? You know, like you mentioned New York, for instance, as an example. Any employer is any employer in New York? Or is it any job that's in New York that needs to be published? Because you might have a New York-based employer that's saying remote anywhere. Do they then have to say it's 100K or whatever it is, and the person is in Aruba? And are they then now saying, give me my 100K?
Okay.
So there's that issue. The third way to deal with it is go back to old school and have just no like grading and go for individual negotiation. Do we see an opportunity for that to come back as a solution to all of this? It's like, we're not going to publish any pay scales. You talk to me, we'll figure it out. That's how we're going to set pay. Does all of these pressures and complications bring back old school? Thoughts on this? What's the optimal thing people should do based on, you know, what kind of business they're at? Let's go around. So Andrew, go to you first with this.
I think that there was a lot of questions there, and I didn't write them all down. But I think where you get started is you either have a premium strategy or a discount strategy for location. So you have a base pay, and in some cases you'll probably have a premium or a discount based on highly technical or critical jobs for your organization. And then on top of that, you're going to then lay in the premium or the discount based on locations. I think that concept is well established and used in a number of locations. As far as, you know, let the market kind of dictate, I think the problem we still run with is candidly the Nexus problem. Is not everyone can just hire anybody they want wherever they work, because not every company can just go ahead and, you know, I can't hire in Scotland. I mean, if I did, I'd have to set a tax base in Scotland. So I think that the transparency problem here is what's really available for as an employer. I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think that those are the things you got to do. You got to figure out what can we do. There's what's feasible. There's what's what we can dream, but then there's what's technically feasible.
And so there's a practicality issue, isn't there? Like in other words, you might have the principle you want to do this, but it will come with loads of practical issues that can't be solved. And in fact, I was just wondering, I was going to bring this up at some point, but our sponsor today is Oyster HR. They're a billion-dollar business in terms of the valuation. They're trying to solve this problem by saying, we're going to sort all of this out. Like, you can hire anybody. Just use it. Put this person through Oyster. We're going to make sure they're tax compliant. We're going to make sure there's an entity there. Yada, yada, yada. It's done. So I think there's them. There's a couple of other companies in that space. but do you see a technology solution to some of these practical problems that we're encountering? So in other words, these problems may not be persistent. There's going to be some software that sorts it out at some point.
I think it's very much technology based. It's payroll issues. It's a pension that we talked about. And, you know, those initial flags around permanent establishments and managing those elements. So with a really good technological solution, that's part of the battle dealt with on the corporate side, on the employee side. Going back to Andrew's point, it's really about what the company's sort of trying to focus on, its strategy, and how much money it's got to spend as well.
It's not a coincidence that there's vast amounts of money going into payroll tech just now.
The cost varies widely. Sorry, the cost varies widely as well. We do work with a payrolling company as well. And France is a good example where we are not registered in France, but we work in a lot of French-speaking countries. So when we have to payroll someone through a third party, the markup is, you know, an additional 50 to 75%. Versus in the US, if we payroll somebody, it's an additional like 20, 25%. And even I tried payrolling someone in Israel, and that was like another 75% on top of their salary or something, right? So you do, there's cost implications even to the payrolling based on the country's, like social structure.
I mean, that creates a moral question as well, because if you're prepared to pay that amount for that job to get done, and the employee is therefore worth that amount, but there's a payroll intermediary claiming 75, you know, or whatever it is, 40% of that total number, that creates a question as well.
Well, you're also talking in the difference between the cost of the company and the wages that the employee takes home. So, you know, Megan, to your point, you can have someone in Israel and they're earning, you know, 100. And okay, maybe that's on par with the 100 they're making in another, they could have been making in another country, but the cost to the actual organization could be 200 in Israel, but only 150 somewhere else because of taxes, et cetera. And so I think that when we look at these issues, we tend to think of it in terms of wages rather than expenses. And I think that that's got to be part of the dialogue that the employers have on how they strategize and what does it mean for them to make their teams and then manage their teams.
Oh, Andrew, you've just mentioned something there that reminded me of a conversation in that LinkedIn thread I had with this CTO guy in San Francisco. And he actually mentioned this point to say, it's not so much about what I'm paying this person. It's also what are the penalties associated with this person being in that location to the team and the business. Like, for instance, if there is a time zone issue, it's not straightforward whether that person is going to be as productive in terms of overall contribution on aggregate to the team if the person is on the same time zone, because we have to then shift our behavior to accommodate this person. Now, from a legal and compliance point of view, that's also part of that piece. So would we end up like paying, say, a universal salary, but also having this weird like plus minus calculus to figure out actually you're based in Aruba, that's going to cost us this amount of productivity issue because, you know, most of our guys are based in Sydney or something and it's like different time zone. We can only pay you this. So maybe a super complicated way to calculate the final number rather than being able to punch out, you know, a transparent salary. So, you know, one of the big movements we have right now is we should go salary transparency. I think, again, that's an idealistic position, which I think is optimal in the ideal case. But I think we're going to encounter a lot of practical issues that will make it very difficult for us to sustain that publicity. Okay, we have to go to questions because we're burning huge amounts of time. Let's go to... Okay, so Lee Candiotti's asked this question. Megan, this is directly to you. So how do you calculate the cost of labor? I think this is to an earlier reference to when you're hiring people in different locations. How do you come up with that number?
Yeah, I think, although his question, sorry, the cost of labor, first of all, I don't calculate it. The head of compensation of Ben calculates it. And I don't think she calculates it. I think she buys it from somebody, right? So it's instead of cost of living, it's cost of labor. Those things are, I think, usually pretty closely linked, but not always exactly the same, right? It's availability, education level, that sort of thing, cost of labor in the market.
Yeah, and you can get that information, can't you, through local suppliers, I guess. I mean, there'll be organizations, talent intelligence companies will provide that sort
of somebody.
Information. Yeah, cool. Okay, let's go to the next question. This is from Dino. Dino is saying, wouldn't a policy suggested higher salaries in other words, location adjusted, make employees move to those areas in order to grow their salaries? So in other words, if there is location adjustment, would that actually promote labor mobility? People will move to those places. And would this be add more pressure to already overpopulated areas? Thoughts on this? I mean, I think the answer's got to be yes, right? I mean,
if you live on a park bench, then absolutely, 100%.
Right. Yes. Right. It wildly dependent upon the individual, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I could see, for example, okay, so my parents have a home in San Francisco. If I could move in with my folks again and bring my whole family and make more money and live with my parents in San Francisco, that's awesome. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Sign me up. But I'm pretty sure that if I move from San Francisco, there are cost of living adjustments that the reason why you're making more money is because of how you're living there. So I think it kind of comes out in the wash a little bit.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, cost. I think I have a colleague who is from Afghanistan, and he was sending money home to his family, and they found out what his salary was in U.S. dollars in New York, and they kept saying, "We don't understand why you can't send us more," right? And he said to me, "They don't understand that I go to lunch and it's $10." You know, cost of living it eats into your highest salary.
I wonder if you've got, you know, how companies set up registered offices in like somebody's registered office in Manhattan so they can say they've got a New York address. I wonder if employees could do that. They could set up a registered, I've got a registered address in San Francisco, but I actually live in Utah. In order to claim the San Francisco salary.
This is what I'm talking about. Like, there will be fraudulent behavior of this type, and we're going to start seeing it.
You normally come up with these schemes.
I love exploiting the system. I have no problem with it. Actually, I do. I mean, theoretically, I have enjoyment over it, right?
You're a hacker.
I had a drink with a friend of a friend, and this person was working two permanent jobs. Neither employer knew the other. And that was the first example, in-person example of what we think is a myth. But no, this person was working for two different companies, didn't know each other. They didn't know each other. He was earning two salaries. That's kind of fraudulent, obviously, but he's like making max buck off that. And I was like, okay, clearly this happens because wherever the system can be exploited, it will be exploited. It's not just about morality. It's about, look, can you get away with it? Okay.
Hang on. They get caught for that because they're tax code, don't they? Payroll.
Maybe he's working one through a company and the other. Maybe he's working both on companies, but he's agreed to be permanent on one side and, you know, it's permanent both sides. But actually, no, there's loads of little dodges you can do. Okay, so this is Lee again. Let's have a look at this question. So Lee's saying, okay, if your pay is location is based on cost of living, where you happen to live, how about third-party solo recruiters charge less to employers because they live in Wichita? Okay, so I don't think that's a question, only. It's kind of like a statement to say, you know, people don't charge less based on their cost of living, although arguably they do. I mean, this is why you offshore stuff. The reason why, Adam, you're using sort of software developers in Chennai is because exactly that's happening. So, Lee, I don't actually think that's true. Okay. That's the end of the questions. I think this has been gone. Adam, go ahead.
I've got one quick question. Thing. Just a quick point, which is one thing we probably haven't done in this show is we haven't had anybody who's been like absolutely vehement. You need to pay people exactly the same because they're producing the same value to your organization. So I don't think any of us have really said that. I have seen people like Chad Sowas, for example, is absolutely vehement about that you have to pay them the same. So we haven't quite had the other side on this. But
I think what will happen though, I think the companies that have gone to a commitment to transparency, I think will have to go to universal pay. And I think that may work or not. It will depend on how it works for their business, but there's probably more problems down the track for that than maybe they currently are aware of. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, but if that is your point, if that is your point, which is people should be paid the same no matter where they are, I wonder, actually, is that the same moral question around why do we outsource to lower cost locations? Why do we outsource to, I mean, Scotland's full of like call centers and shared service centers because they're too expensive in London. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that it's the same question around outsourcing and North Shoring and all those types of things.
But that will put pressure on it because presumably there'll be less offshoring because of the cost elements.
Of course, and then the Philippines would miss out or whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, fascinating. Anyway, listen, folks, we're going to have to put an end to the show. It's been a fascinating conversation. I think it's obvious that just having this chat, it's clear that there's just so much more to talk about because this is going to be like an ongoing issue for a lot of us going forward. So hopefully all of us who work in the compensation and benefits sector are going to do good with this yourselves because there'll be a huge demand for this type of work. So I just want to thank everyone for joining us. So thank you so much. Andrew, for joining the show. Great to see you, sir. You have a very good weekend. Richard Gibbs, great to see you as well. Thank you for joining the show. Great to have your input and wisdom. Have a great weekend. And Megan, great to see you. Thank you for joining the show. And thanks for your input. Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too.
Wow, how interesting was that? I'm fascinated about this because I do think, you know, the top level ideas are going to just be broken down by implementation. When people actually roll out a policy without thinking through the implications of all of it, they're going to get a case that's going to really hurt them. Anyway, that's about it. We'll be back next week. We're talking about how to set up a recruitment operations function, recruiter enablement, folks. So if you care about thinking, how do I make my recruiters better and more efficient? There's suddenly people are doing recruitment ops. What do they do? How do they make people more efficient? We've got some recruitment ops people in there, and they're going to help us talk through that. So make sure you follow the channel and register for the show next week. Okay, that's it. We'll see you next week.
Cheers.
Whew, that was all right, I think. I was a bit tired, I've got to be honest, but I think it was a good, decent show, Adam. Well done. I think you were a bit tired as well for some reason.
Friday, mate.
Yeah. By the way, I was about to say just a quick chat on what is it? This the Khan Brook fight. Are you interested in that? Kell Brook versus Amir Khan.
Yeah, I am. Is it? When is it?
Soon. I mean, they're starting to promote it.
Yeah. I mean, they're both practically retired. So
yeah, they're knackered.
Kell Brook's last fight, he got. He started really great against Terence Crawford. Like first three rounds, he was brilliant, and then he just got knocked out in the fourth round or something.
He's had his orbital bone like smashed in the last two fights. Like he shouldn't probably be in the ring again.
Yeah, Amir Khan's not a huge puncher though, so he's been he was active. I think he fought last year. I'm pretty sure he did. He fought last year.
Oh, we've lost Adam. That's fair enough. He was boxing chat anyway. Right, anyway, that's it. I think I'm going to have to go to bed.